Well, tonight, the World Cup officially kicks off, starting with the opening ceremonies. For the next month, teams from across the globe are competing in South Africa. But for the millions of fans around the world, soccer is much more than just a sport or just a game. It's a way of life. And for Stephen and Harrison Stark, it's an indicator of world diplomacy. This is like Stratego on the soccer pitch. This is a father and son team. They're authors of the new book, The Indispensable Guide to Soccer and Geopolitics, World Cup 2010. And they're here in the studio with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
Hey, how are you?
Must read for members of the National Security Council and people at the State Department, right, since the World Cup is kicking off?
I would think so. What do you think, Harry?
Absolutely.
Now, why? What are they going to learn from learning about the geopolitics of soccer while Brazil is playing Algeria, while the United States is playing England?
Well, the thing is, Americans tend to think of this holy trinity of baseball, football, and basketball as unbreakable. But for the rest of the world—
And a little ice hockey just for
that. And a little ice hockey, of course. But starting tonight, the rest of the world will absolutely stop. Soccer is not only the most popular sport in the world, its scope goes beyond that of any single world religion. It's estimated that 3.5 billion people watched the last World Cup final, and it's expected that 1 in 2 people will be watching this tournament. So because of its global appeal, soccer becomes a sort of common denominator. Because every country plays the same, 11 players kicking a ball for 90 minutes, the different ways that countries play soccer on the field and their fans experience it off it always reveals something fundamentally true about the country.
Okay, well, let's take a couple of the top teams. Brazil, Spain is one of the favorites, Spain. Right? Give me, Dad, Stephen Stark, give me the interpretation of Spain's perhaps style of play and where they are, like maybe in the EU. I know I'm getting specific.
Well, they're a very good team. Right. But they're one of the chronic underachievers of world soccer. Uh-huh. They have never gone past the quarterfinals of the World Cup. And historically, the reasons for that is that, and historians know this, it's a very atomized country, not a strong central authority. And so what you have is the people in Catalonia don't like the people in Andalusia, who don't like the people in Madrid. And it's very hard to maintain team unity on that team, essentially. I mean, there's an old European joke, 4 Spaniards, 5 opinions. And that tends to sort of infiltrate the locker room of the Spanish, and they tend to fall apart in almost every tournament they're in.
Now, everybody wants to know about Brazil.
Brazil is, the great team. They're the largest country in the world that has made soccer a kind of a priority, that it's the national sport. And also, very interestingly about Brazil, they were one of the first countries to fully integrate their team back in the 30s when we still had segregated baseball.
Which is also a reflection of their society.
Absolutely. It's very much a reflection of the society. And Brazil has defined itself through soccer in the same way that the English think of themselves as sort of the nation of Shakespeare, of a certain literary style. Brazil thinks of itself as the nation of Pelé, a nation that plays soccer in a very distinctive, free-flowing, almost carnival-like way.
That's the so-called beautiful game. Well, Harrison, let me ask you about that. Your dad's talking about the beautiful game in Brazil, but I'm reading articles, including in the Washington Post last night, saying the beautiful game is gone on this team. Brazil has a new style which is disciplined and focused and to a lot of people seems very un-Brazil-like. Are they losing their identity on the pitch this year?
I would say absolutely not. It's a new formation, which is very un-Brazilian, featuring 2 defensive midfielders, which up until now in Brazil is complete sacrilege. You know, it's attack, attack, attack. But what you actually see is that even though the team starts out defensively with 2 defensive midfielders, it's very dynamic formation where players are constantly switching positions. And actually, the reason there are 2 defensive midfielders is so they can purely come back and cover for the wingbacks, who are 2 of the most attacking wingbacks since Cafu and Roberto Carlos.
Mm-hmm. And now, what about, I love all this geopolitical stuff. Give us, I like the Spain and Brazil. How about North Korea? There's a big team.
They are, first of all, we don't know much about them. They're not world-class publicists, as we all know. What's interesting about North Korea's style is they are probably the most defensive team you will ever see at the World Cup. They play 5 men at the back, which is almost unheard of, and even their strikers tend to come back. Well, it's a very defensive nation. They don't let people in. They don't let people out. It's said that when you go down train tracks in North Korea, there are walls so that you can't even see out. The goalkeeper for the team has said that when I'm keeping net for North Korea, my job is to keep the invaders out. Well, again, you're not going to hear that from another team.
And yet you can't advance very far in the world or on the pitch unless you put some
points in the net unless you score some goals.
Yeah, and unfortunately for them, they're in a very tough group with Brazil, right. Portugal, and Cote d'Ivoire. So
that's the group of death, right? That's the G group.
It's one of the groups of death, right? And so chances are they're going to go out. And, of course, the big question is, what does North Korea do politically when they suffer this great humiliation? When they didn't qualify several cups ago, they didn't even try to enter the World Cup for a couple times for fear of humiliation. Right.
Harrison, I want to end on a little bit of analysis that concerns the United States. Now, you have the first game on Saturday. Can't wait for the U.S. to play England. These are two global allies. George Bush said the United States has no closer friend than the United Kingdom. Enemies on the soccer pitch, what are we going to glean from this?
Well, I think it's very interesting. If we're talking about geopolitics reflecting in the style, the United States is a very individualistic team. Even for all our talk about, you know, team unity, and we have players in every position, in the Confederations Cup, a third of the team's shots were taken by one player, Clint Dempsey, and the U.S. was outshot 2-1. Meaning that we're very over-reliant on Dempsey for attacking options. That's a lot of shots for a midfielder. And Tim Howard, who's very talented. I think it's going to be a close game because both teams are weak at the back and have a lot of offensive options.
What's interesting about both these teams is that the United States and England are probably the two nations that most overrate their chances. Most nations go in quite pessimistic. We were talking to a group of Brazilians last night. You know, don't jinx us. Over 50% of the English in the latest poll thought they were going to win the World Cup, which is absurd because they're probably not. So, interesting matchup there.
All right, Stephen and Harrison Stark, co-authors of The Indispensable Guide to Soccer and Geopolitics, World Cup 2010. Harrison, who's going to win?
We think Brazil.
Dad?
I'm going with Brazil because Harrison says so. Absolutely.
Pull it together. Well, you're all geared up.
Wow, father and son.
Yeah. Both predicting Brazil. Well, let's hope for the U.S. on Saturday. If you're all geared up for the World Cup, tune in tomorrow when we have more. And tell us why the rest of us must watch South Africa-Mexico game on Friday and the game between the U.S. and England on Saturday. Of course, that you can chime in at thetakeaway.org and find us on Facebook.com/thetakeaway.